This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Is in The Guardian and New Inquiry and elsewhere. Her latest piece, The Babies We Don't Care About Today. She's author of the book Penny Red, Notes from the New Age of Dissent. This is Democracy Now!, and that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Cassandra Lazare, Messiah Rhodes, Sharina Nadura, Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee, Christian Goff, and Vesta Godarz, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Ra Campenny, and Carlo DeJesus. Go to our website at democracynow.org. You can see the transcripts of every show. You can listen to every show. You can watch it and you can tweet about it. Go to our Facebook page. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. Up next is KBOO Evening News after these messages.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6 p.m. to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
The Portland Surfrider Foundation advocates for strong marine water quality regulations, adequate water quality monitoring, reporting, and posting, and for the reduction of polluted discharges into the ocean. It currently has two active clean water campaign initiatives in the Newport and Cannon Beach areas. In support of their efforts, the Surfrider Summer Soiree is being held July 25th at the Holocene from 6 p.m. till 1 a.m. The event includes an art show, silent auction, music by the Renegade String Band, and screening of the surf film Heart and the Sea. Proceeds benefit the Portland chapter of the Surfrider Foundation's Clean Water Campaign. More information about the event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Port of Vancouver's commission endorses the largest crude oil terminal, export terminal in the Northwest.
Natural gas workers in Louisiana are evacuated following a rig blowout.
And the Egyptian death toll rises as the military continues to clash with Morsi supporters.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday.
Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. I'm Ross Freeman Levin.
And I'm Diane Erickson. The Port of Vancouver's commission voted 3-0 this morning to endorse the largest crude oil terminal in the Northwest. Tesoro Petroleum wants to partner with Savage Services to build a terminal capable of shipping 360,000 barrels a day. Tesoro officials have said that Washington's Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council will address the safety issues in depth in a later review. For more on this story, KBOO reporter Ross Freeman Levin spoke with Dan Sear with Columbia Riverkeeper.
This is Ross Freeman Levin for KBOO News. Today I'm talking with Dan Sears of Columbia Riverkeeper. Dan, can you tell me what happened today with the Port of Vancouver's approval of the oil export terminal?
Sure. Thanks, Ross. So So this morning, despite hearing from dozens of people last night at a hearing that went almost till 10 o'clock in the evening, the Port of Vancouver decided to move forward and issue a lease for a huge oil terminal with the capacity to ship 380,000 barrels of oil a day, of crude oil, from North Dakota, Canada, and Montana through a proposed terminal at the Port of Vancouver. So the terminal is being proposed by Tesoro and Savage Companies. And again, at 380,000 barrels a day, that's roughly half the capacity of the Keystone XL pipeline, one of the most controversial projects in North America. The proposed terminal would handle the same type of oil that caused a massive explosion and fire in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, killing an estimated 50 people. The people of Vancouver showed up in force last night and raised very detailed, reasonable safety concerns about the impact of this project on their community. Many people also spoke to the greenhouse gas pollution impact of the project, which would be enormous, roughly equating to about 12 million cars worth of CO2 alone just from the burning of the oil, not even from drilling and shipping it. So it's an enormous project and an enormous negative impact on the community. And of course, from Riverkeeper's perspective, we're also very concerned about the potential, the increased potential for a huge oil spill or even a small spill in the Columbia River. For everyone who lives near Portland and Vancouver, and even particularly for those who live downstream in communities like Rainier and elsewhere, a spill in the Columbia River affects fish, it affects drinking water, it affects regionally critical economic and ecological resource. And we think the Port of Vancouver has decided to gamble on this terminal. We're calling on Governor Inslee and the state of Washington to take a much more reasoned, a much more in-depth look at the real impact of what a 380,000 barrel per day oil terminal would mean for the Columbia River.
From what I'm understanding, despite the public input, the commission made their 3-0 decision. Is there any next step in the permitting and approval process, or is this a final vote? At what point are we in the process, and can the public still have their voices heard and have an impact, say, on elected officials or decision makers?
You know, the Port of Vancouver decided essentially to sidestep and to ignore many of the concerns of the people of Vancouver. And those concerns came from longshoremen and from business owners. One of the biggest private developers in Vancouver spoke out against the terminal last night. So those voices need to be raised again when it comes to the state of Washington and Governor Inslee. So the process isn't over. In fact, it's just beginning. So we're encouraging everyone to contact Governor Inslee and make sure that he knows what the stakes are for Vancouver and for the Columbia River. The carbon consequences of this project and the environmental catastrophe in the waiting for this project are too big to ignore. And so the state of Washington can absolutely turn this project down. And the governor of Washington, Governor Inslee, has a huge responsibility and role in rejecting this huge oil terminal that our community doesn't need and doesn't want.
Dan, it sounds like there's ample opportunity for public input on this. Are there any specific websites you would point people to get more information to inform themselves about what this oil export terminal means to residents of our geographic region?
Yeah, absolutely. People can find more information at ColumbiaRiverkeeper.org. You can also find information regarding upcoming events with summer heat. So there's going to be a big paddle event coming up this weekend. One of the issues that will be talked about there will be this oil terminal alongside coal and liquefied natural gas exports. This terminal fits into this larger pattern of big energy companies trying to use the Columbia River as a fossil fuel superhighway. And people are going to be out in the river making a statement this weekend. So I encourage people to look into that. I think it's on the KBOO calendar and get plugged in.
Thanks again, Dan, for bringing this to our attention and helping our audience be informed on what oil export terminals in Vancouver would mean to the area. I appreciate your time today, and thanks for talking to KBOO.
Thank you, Ross.
Most Oregon families who live in poverty are working families. According to the Oregon Center for Public Policy, 7 out of 10 families with children in poverty have one or more working parents, many of whom are employed full-time. Single working moms are also in worse economic shape than single working dads. In 2011, 33% of all single working mothers live below the poverty line, compared to 20% of single working fathers. Among single parents working full-time, 14% of single mothers lived in poverty versus 5% of single fathers. The Oregon Center for Public Policy reported that full-time, minimum wage jobs don't support a single parent family with two children. The Washington, D.C.-based think tank, the Economic Policy Institute, recently reported that a secure standard of living for a family of four in Oregon requires at least 2.5 times of poverty-level income.
Beginning in September, Oregonians will be able to compare health care plans from 11 different insurers as part of the state's effort to comply with the coming Affordable Health Care Act. KBOO's Don Merrill talked with a Cover Oregon spokesperson about the effort to enroll almost 250,000 Oregonians by March 2014.
I'm Lisa Murowski, and I'm the communications manager at Cover Oregon.
Cover Oregon is Oregon's brand new health insurance exchange.
We're a new online marketplace opening in the fall where Oregonians are going to be able to compare and enroll in health coverage and also access financial help to help pay for their coverage.
Ms. Murkowski said Cover Oregon is ramping up its advertising and outreach campaign in order to make people aware of the fact that the Affordable Care Act is coming and to get people enrolled in the program by the start of the program on January 1st.
We're doing a lot of training of insurance agents and community organizations who will be available to help people enroll in the fall. But we're also just getting the word out and starting to let people know about the changes that are coming.
Well, in some of the discussions that I've heard about the Affordable Care Act and the pool of people that they're going to try to get into the health plan, the emphasis has always been on young people because they said that if you just have a bunch of old sick people in the program, then, you know, you're not going to really have the money or the resources to be able to maintain it because, you know, those people are older and sicker, and so they're going to cost more for health care.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely heard that argument as well. So like I said, that, you know, young and healthy folks are definitely a key audience for us in our outreach. But, you know, we also want to reach the broader Oregonians as well.
It says that you want to try to reach 217,000 people between October and March. Now, is that's reaching people or getting that many people to enroll by then?
That is enroll. Those are our enrollment goals.
You have projections that'll tell you whether or not you're going to hit those numbers? I mean, what is it about the plan that you think will compel that many people in that short of a time to join?
You know, we're an online marketplace. And so it's going to be a place where people can go and easily compare plans apples to apples. It's been really difficult in the past to compare your health coverage options because the benefits have been very different among plans, and there hasn't been a central place to go look. So we think that people will really enjoy that shopping experience. It'll make it a lot easier for them to see what's available to them and compare and find the plan that best meets their needs. Another really important piece of it is the financial help that's going to be available. There's going to be help paying for premiums and also for out-of-pocket costs like deductibles and copays. And the assistance is available to individuals and families. Actually, a family of four earning up to $94,000 a year could be eligible for financial help. So that's a lot of Oregonians who are going to be eligible for that financial assistance. And that's only available through Cover Oregon. So we think that will draw a lot of people in.
And Ms. Murowski says that the reception from local insurers has been very good.
Well, we've got a really good response from the insurance companies. We already have the carriers set who are going to be participating in Cover Oregon. So we have 11 carriers who are going to be offering plans. We've been working with the carriers really for the past 2 years because this has been under development in Oregon for about 2 years. And so we brought the carriers on early in the process to kind of help us shape Cover Oregon and to help them prepare as well for these big changes that are coming.
And I guess the last thing I want to ask you is whenever there's a big program like this, there are always people who are in danger of being scammed. Is Cover Oregon working in any way with the state attorney general to protect people from enrolling in something that they think is Cover Oregon or some kind of insurance plan, and really it's just a scam to take their money?
You know, we've heard that concern before. We're going to be certifying agents and community partners, and so it's really important for people to check to make sure if they're working with an agent or a community organization that they're one of our partners. So we are really going to be encouraging people to go to our website or call our 800 number so they can check to make sure that the person they're working with has been trained and knows the plans and is certified by us.
If people want more information about Cover Oregon, where can they go?
They can go to our website. That's the best place for them to go right now. It's coveroregon.com. And we have a, they can sign up for email updates from us, and we'll be having more information leading up to open enrollment in October. We also have a tax credit calculator on our website where people can go in and get an estimate of how much financial help they might be eligible for.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Went up almost. The home tracking website Zillow says home prices in the Portland area went up almost 13% in June. The median price for a home in Portland rose 12.8% to $248,300 over the last 12 months. But Zillow says the double-digit growth in the local market cannot be sustained. Looking ahead, Zillow expects home prices to increase again over the next 12 months, but the pace will drop to a more modest 5%. The biggest gains were seen in Beaverton, Aloha, and Milwaukee, all at 17%.
This morning, Mayor Hales called out dozens of police to sweep the vigil camp in front of City Hall. Two were arrested. Vigil protesters bring attention to houseless issues and assert sleep as a human right. Activists have been holding vigil 24/7 outside City Hall since December of 2011. KBOO's Joe Meyer slipped out and filed this report.
Mayor Hales held a press conference yesterday showing off his new tool for keeping protesters away from City Hall. The designation of City Hall sidewalks as high pedestrian use zones, where no one is allowed to sit or lie down. This would be a major change at the nearly two-year-old vigil to end homelessness in front of City Hall. This morning, when dozens of Portland police officers swept the sidewalk, two activists asserted their constitutional rights. Here's Jim just before his arrest.
I'm getting arrested for sitting in the sidewalk while they're cleaning it. I think this should be a space that's open for the public, and the law says that too. But Charlie came up with an ordinance he found for this block, the next block, and it says that we can't be here during the daytime. So we're gonna contest that. It's an emergency ordinance passed in 2010. I just had a stroke recently. That's why I had a heart attack. That's why I'm speaking kind of funny. We'll be being out here again as soon as we get out of jail. We'll come back again. Just civilians, we're citizens, that we go home at night, but we're supporting the protesters and the occupiers. It's what everybody in this town should do. The ones that don't do it are chicken. They're afraid. And I understand it's not fun to be arrested, but you have to test the system every so often.
And here's longtime activist Joe Walsh just moments before his arrest.
We have a right to say to this city council, we are petitioning you, and we have a right to say it on the sidewalk. The Oregon Appellate Court has said this is holy ground. The sidewalk is holy ground, and the police are not going to move us. They're going to arrest us, I assume. I don't like a police state. And if you look around, this is a police state. Look at how many cops we have. Look at all of this stuff. Who's paying for all this? You know, they could have two cops here. We're not going to give him a hard time. I'm on oxygen. He's in a chair. So we're not going to bother them. They could send a retired cop to take us in. We're not going to resist. So all of this is just drama. But it costs the taxpayers of Portland a lot of money. Look at all these guys. All these guys, these cops, they make anywhere from $70,000 to $150,000 a year.
I asked the arresting officer about Joe's constitutional rights.
I'm saying, does a cop on the beat have to consider this man's constitutional rights?
Absolutely.
And you've considered them?
Absolutely.
What do you think?
We're protecting them.
You're protecting his constitutional rights? No, he thinks his constitutional rights to stay on the sidewalk.
We all have opinions.
Okay.
After most of the police moved on, a protester wearing half a pair of glasses sums up the new vigil rules, starting with the City Hall courtyard.
This area, which had normally had 24-hour access, is now going to be considered off-limits from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. They've just taken down the prayer vigil that's been here since December of 2011 or January 2012, which is pretty tragic considering this community lets 50-plus homeless people die each year.
What about the rules for sleeping out?
It looks like they were sort of trapped by their own laws. Technically, it remains illegal for people to cover up at night, but we know the authorities ignore their own laws because 2,000 people have to cover up on the street every night, and most of them don't get harassed by the police. So from 9 p.m. till 7 a.m., people are permitted to be laying on the sidewalks. In theory, they can't be covering themselves, but we don't expect them to enforce that about people covering up, except when they're mad at us.
You notice anything on the federal side today?
The feds came by and didn't like the little polyhedral structure of the prayer vigil, and we moved that back out to the sidewalk. So the feds are in synchronicity about the no structures law.
Stay tuned to KABU for continuing coverage. And this is Joe Meyer with KABU News.
Old Town Street Paper is currently hosting an auction to benefit its programs. According to the Oregonian, Street Roots, a publication whose mission is to help those who cannot afford free speech, opened its fifth annual online auction on Friday. Revenues from the auction benefit the production of the paper itself, as well as its homeless population advocacy programs and the Rose City Resource Guides. The auction will be open through Monday and features 107 music, food, and beer and event items. For more information about the auction and Street Roots, visit streetroots.org.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed at 6 by Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, part of a series celebrating KABU's 45th anniversary year. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be much like today's, with high temperatures reaching 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Lows tonight should be around 60 degrees.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Most of America's corporate, political, and media cognoscenti are street-preaching proselytizers of the holy virtues of NAFTA-style trade deals. Believe, they shout with the fervor of corporatized Elmer Gantries. But the people, damn them, are not buying the hokum because, well, because it's hokum. Most Americans have felt, or at least seen, the destructive impact of these trade scams. Thousands of factories closed and millions of jobs gone south. They now consider NAFTA to be a five-letter profanity. Last year, the Angus Reid polling firm found that only one in four Americans thinks NAFTA has benefited workers, and more than half of those polled believe the trade deal is so bad that the U.S. should either renegotiate or simply leave NAFTA. Likewise, just before 2010's volatile congressional elections, an NBC Wall Street Journal poll showed that 69% of voters believe that free trade agreements cost the U.S. jobs, and even 61% of self-identified Tea Party adherents shared that opinion. A whopping 86% said corporate outsourcing of our jobs to low-wage countries was the top cause of America's economic woes. In an especially interesting finding, the link between trade and outsourcing was one issue on which people of different classes, occupations, and political views all agreed. On the other hand, polls also show that the public now sees the deceit in the Cognoscenti's constant claim that Americans believe in free trade. Well, yes, people can support the theory of free trade, but they've learned from experience that trade theory is far different than the reality of the deals hung around our necks. This is Jim Hightower saying, while the Cognoscenti insist that the U.S. should continue to be a member of NAFTA, that sermon gets an amen from only 15% of Americans. No more NAFTAs.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, 47 workers were safely evacuated from a natural gas drilling rig off the Louisiana following a well blowout. The Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, or BSEE, said inspectors observed a 50-foot by one-half-mile light sheen on the water that appeared to be quickly dissipating. The blowout occurred about 55 miles offshore south of Grand Isle in water 154 feet deep. This is the second gas well leak this month. In 2010, an exploding oil rig resulted in the worst offshore drilling disaster in the United States, as millions of gallons of oil spewed into the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. A spokeswoman for the BSEE said today's blowout occurred at an unmanned offshore gas platform where no gas was being produced. The workers were on a portable drilling rig known as a jackup rig. Hercules Offshore was operating the rig for the Walter Oil and Gas Corporation in Houston. The rig was completing a sidetrack well where they drill an additional well into the original to alleviate problems. The spokesperson for Walter Oil and Gas said additional information will be forthcoming.
Today, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont claimed that the current White House-backed bill on college loan interest rates will actually raise rates much higher than projected. Sanders, a member of the Senate Education Committee, accused the White House during public comments of deliberately hiding true interest rate increases. Sanders alleged more students will graduate with significant debt, and in some cases, many will decide not to go to college because they can't afford it. Projections from the Congressional Budget Office suggest that undergraduate interest rates will rise to 7.25% in the next 5 years. Graduate loans would rise to 8.8%, and college loan rates would reach 9.8% in 2018. The Senate is expected to vote on the student loan proposal later this week.
Yesterday, U.S. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey warned government officials that U.S. military intervention in Syria could cost billions. Dempsey voiced his concerns regarding U.S. military intervention in the Syrian crisis in a letter to Senator John McCain and Senate Armed Services Chairman Carl Levin. According to Politico.com, the letter outlined five possible options that the Pentagon is prepared to take, including training, advising, and assisting the opposition. Dempsey also advocated the military conduct limited standoff strikes, control chemical weapons, and establish no-fly and buffer zones. Dempsey warned that each option would be both costly and risky. Four of the five options would involve lethal force with estimated cost of $1 billion a month. The United States' current military involvement with the Syria crisis is currently limited to humanitarian assistance, providing security assistance to Syria's neighbors, and providing non-lethal assistance to the opposition.
The death toll from the clashes between the Egyptian military and supporters of Mohamed Morsi has risen to its highest levels yet. Egypt was thrown into turmoil recently after the military overthrew the country's first democratically elected leader. Most of the latest casualties died in pre-dawn battles that erupted near a pro-Morsi support camp, and fighting continues in the street. The clashes began after pro-Morsi supporters started marching from a sit-in outside Cairo University's main campus toward a nearby mosque. The procession of protesters created enormous traffic jams and made many local residents angry. Officials say the protests turned deadly after an unidentified masked gunman began firing live ammunition and birdshot into the crowd of protesters. The Muslim Brotherhood blamed the shootings on so-called thugs sponsored by the Interior Ministry and the military. Khalid El
Kati, who heads the Health Ministry's Emergency and Intensive Care Divisions, said that six people were killed near the pro-Morsi sit-in, bringing the toll to 7 killed and 11 injured. 2 weeks ago, at least 54 people were killed in a clash between Morsi supporters and security forces, the deadliest since the coup. Yesterday, the deposed president's family denounced the military in a news conference and accused the military of kidnapping Morsi. European diplomats have urged the military to release Morsi.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. Israeli troops attack a local school in the West Bank, and Egypt closes the Rafah border crossing in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli troops invaded on Tuesday morning the town of Hawara near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Local sources said that soldiers searched and ransacked a number of homes, then took control of a local school for boys. When the night guard at the school found the soldiers inside the school, he called the Palestinian Ministry of Education in Nablus. The ministry representative and the mayor of Hawara arrived at the school and were forced to leave after soldiers threatened them, the sources added. The Israeli forces left the school shortly after. In the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, the Egyptian authorities told the Palestinian side of the Rafah border crossing between the coastal region and Egypt that the terminal will be closed today to celebrate the anniversary of July 23rd uprising and will resume work on Wednesday. The Rafah crossing is the only way for Gazans in or out of the region since Israel placed the strip under siege 6 years ago. In other news, 4 Jordanian political detainees held by the Israeli army entered on Tuesday their 80th day of hunger strike, demanding the halt of ill-treatment by their captives and their freedom. According to their lawyer, Hanan Al-Khatib, who visited them today, all 4 of them are suffering from lack of medical care and often are abused by Israeli soldiers. Al-Khatib called on the international and local human rights groups to intervene to save the lives of those political prisoners. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, July 23rd news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Seamus Sloan White and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Merrill, Joe Meyer, Patrick McLaughlin, Kelsang Nima, Rosalind Scott, Ren Green, Stephen Sherritt, and Carl Vischer. The producer is me. Special thanks to all our team. Our engineer tonight is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ross Freeman Levin.
And I'm Diane Erickson. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday, talk show host Lisa Loving speaks with Jesse O'Brien from Osprey about the new study that shows that people with cancer, heart disease, and other serious conditions are forced to pay 10 times more than necessary for medication. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Ross Freeman Levin interviews Pete Stauffer, Oceans Program Manager for the Surf Rider Foundation, about the work they do upcoming and their upcoming Oregon Summer Soiree. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andree. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter looks at actions taking place in the Pacific Northwest to confront climate crisis with David Osborne and Portland Rising Tide. Tori Cole with 350 PDX Camas Disvestment Team. And Bonnie McKinley, who works on climate issues with Power Pass Coal, Rising Tide, Greenpeace, 350 PDX, and the Sierra Club. Thanks to KBOO members for your generous support in our one-day flash drive on Friday. If you missed it, you can still contribute. Just go to KBOO FM and click on Donate Today. And thank you to KBOO members for raising $10,225 during the flash pledge drive on Friday, July 19th.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Diane.
Good night.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Washington lawmakers take up a more than $500 billion military spending bill and begin to consider a range of amendments covering military action in Syria, drone surveillance, and releasing Guantanamo detainees. New York launches a program to provide legal and educational support for young immigrants who qualify for deferred action. And we'll go to Zimbabwe, where LGBT activists face severe risks and retaliation in their push for equality and rights. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. A Yemeni journalist in prison since 2010 was freed today. Abdullah Hadasheya was reunited with his wife and children following his release. Sheya exposed the United States' role in a 2009 airstrike that killed 35 women and children. He also wrote about the drone war for Al Jazeera and the Washington Post. He was charged with supporting al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and sentenced to 5 years in prison in what press advocates called a sham trial. Shortly after his sentencing and amid public outcry, he was pardoned. But Yemeni-American organizer Rujal Wazir explains that he wasn't immediately released.
When then-President Saleh pardoned him, it was clear that Shaya was still in prison because of Obama, because the next day, immediately, President Saleh got a call from President Obama himself demanding that Shaya go back into prison.
Shaya's story features prominently in Jeremy Scahill's book and subsequent documentary, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano is in the border city of Matamoros today as part of her final trip to Mexico before stepping down from her cabinet position. Shannon Young reports from Laredo.
Today's meeting between DHS Secretary Napolitano and Mexican Interior Secretary Miguel Ángel Osorio Chong takes place in the offices of one of the bridges connecting Brownsville and Matamoros and is reportedly focused on border security. The event was only publicly confirmed over the weekend, and the complete agenda of the meeting was not fully disclosed to the media beforehand. The meeting comes as the U.S. Congress mulls an immigration reform package, which could allot billions of dollars for technology and surveillance for the border region. It's also on the heels of the arrest of a major cartel boss who is wanted in the U.S. The choice of venues for the meeting is also of note. Earlier this month, the U.S. State Department updated its travel advisory for Mexico, issuing strong warnings about the state of Tamaulipas, where Matamoros is located. The warning revealed restrictions in place on the movements of U.S. government employees in the Mexican border state, including nighttime curfews. Napolitano will travel to Mexico City Wednesday to hold further meetings with Mexican cabinet officials. Shannon Young, FSRN, Laredo.
Immigration authorities in the U.K. kicked off a massive campaign to arrest and deport thousands of migrants in the country. Now they are deploying a mobile billboard campaign aimed at undocumented immigrants. Francis Ngwa reports from Liverpool.
The box trucks will drive through areas that are heavily populated by immigrant communities and are emblazoned with graphics that say, "In the UK illegally? Go home or face arrest." The huge posters displayed on the sides of the trucks also note the number of illegal people who were deported and provides contact information for voluntary return. In addition to the mobile and advertisement trucks, leaflets and posters are being distributed. Member of Parliament Sarah Teta criticized the mobile billboards advertising campaign, calling the program nothing less than straightforward intimidation. She accused ministers of creating an anti-immigration rhetoric. But Immigration Minister Mark Harper said the campaign offers undocumented migrants an alternative to being led away in handcuffs. And Home Office officials say voluntary returns are the most cost-effective method of deportation. Francis Ngwa, FSRN, Liverpool.
Protests on the first day of the Pope's visit to Brazil turned violent last night, and the police dispersed the crowd with tear gas. Sam Cowie reports from Rio de Janeiro.
About 1,500 protesters gathered outside of Rio's state government headquarters yesterday as Pope Francisco met with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff and heads of state. Gay rights groups were heavily present in the crowd. Others demanded the impeachment of State Governor Sergio Cabral, while many rallied against the high costs of hosting the Pope for Rio's World Youth Day. Altogether, the Pope's week in Brazil is estimated to cost the public more than $50 million. Wagner Hilmer, a schoolteacher, asked that the Pope tell the President to invest more in public services.
I want the Pope to say to the President that we need less taxes and expenditures, and more health and education. The country needs this.
Rows of riot police and an armored vehicle prevented the protesters from getting near the building. Violence started when a bottle of water was thrown at the police. Officers dispersed the crowd with tear gas, sound bombs and rubber bullets, later telling news agencies that they retaliated only after they were attacked with Molotov cocktails. At least four people were treated at a hospital, two for rubber bullet wounds. Sam Cowie, Free Speech Radio News, Brazil.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, the House took up a more than $500 billion military spending bill today, which could fund the Pentagon and all related agencies for the year 2014. Over the next few days, representatives will consider at least 100 amendments. Some of them aim to release cleared detainees from their indefinite detention at Guantanamo Bay, block funding for military action in Syria, ban the use of drones for domestic surveillance, and defund programs that allow the government to spy on American citizens. As Congress also debates deep cuts to food stamps, education, and affordable housing, many progressive lawmakers and policy advocates say the increases in war and weapons spending show misplaced national priorities. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The House version of the 2014 military spending bill sets aside far more money for weapons, overseas wars, and foreign infrastructure than either the president or the military itself requested. Angela Canterbury, with a project on government oversight, highlighted a few areas where she says spending is particularly wasteful.
The appropriators in Congress decided to provide $1.5 billion more than the Pentagon said it needed for the overseas contingency operations, which is one of the funds for Iraq and Afghanistan spending. And of course, as we're drawing down in those areas, one would presume that we would be decreasing spending. We think that part of that is because there are big moneyed special interests, namely defense contractors who have been lobbying to keep their contracts.
And even as U.S. troops pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan, the government is considering involvement in new battles. Senators Carl Levin and John McCain wrote to U.S. General Martin Dempsey last week, asking him to describe different options for intervening militarily in Syria. In a reply released publicly on Monday, Dempsey outlined several possibilities, including training and advising opposition forces at a cost of $500 million a year, implementing a no-fly zone that would cost $1 billion a month, or conducting limited strikes on the government's military, which he estimates would cost in the billions. About that option, Dempsey also noted that there is a, quote, probability for collateral damage impacting civilians and foreigners inside the country. A proposed amendment to the appropriations bill would bar the president from implementing any of these options without approval from Congress, citing the administration's previous unilateral decision to conduct strikes in Libya. Critics of foreign military aid also sponsored amendments to block any funding of military or paramilitary operations in Egypt and significantly cut back military aid to Pakistan. The list of more than 100 amendments to the bill also includes measures curtailing domestic wiretapping and drone surveillance by defunding certain intelligence programs. On Tuesday, Massachusetts Democrat Jim Moran blasted House Republicans for limiting the debate time on all these amendments to less than 15 minutes each and refusing to hold a vote on many others.
We need to talk about Syria, whether we're going to get sucked into another war. Multiple amendments were offered. All of them were denied except one that basically reinstates current law. There are issues about Egypt that ought to be discussed on the floor. And when I hear my colleagues say, oh, these are sensitive issues, we shouldn't talk about them on the floor, where should we talk about them?
Moran also criticized his colleagues for proposing more money for things like nuclear submarines and armed drones so soon after demanding massive cuts to food stamps, preschool, and low-income housing.
In reality, it's those painful and draconian cuts in the other appropriations bills that allow this defense bill to emerge relatively unscathed.
The military spending bill also continues the ban on transferring any detainees from Guantanamo, either to the U.S. for trial or to be released in another country. New York Democrat Gerald Nadler introduced an amendment to counteract this provision, which would make the U.S. release more than 85 detainees who have been cleared by the government. The Senate will hold a hearing.